So we are talking about the God orientation of congregational worship, and the question at hand then is whether or not, you know, some will say, well, no, we should be focusing on man and our feelings and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so we dealt with the argument of the Psalms there. Another reason people will say that personal, intimate expression should be a part of congregational worship is because they say, well, that's important for people to have, and they're right. But we're going to actually address this a little bit later. But the point here is, and this will be addressed in an entirely separate philosophical point, the difference is that this is congregational worship. This is not personal, private worship. There is a difference. What you do in your personal time of devotion is essential, like we talked about at the beginning of the day, but it is different than what happens in congregational worship because of the nature of the congregation. And what we will talk about that more a little later. Now, I just want to emphasize this is not to deny that hymns of personal testimony are inappropriate. They absolutely are, because they are expressions of response. But the difference, like we've talked about twice already today now, is where's the focus? Is the focus on me and my feelings and my response? Or is the focus on God and His truth and then an expression of my response to that truth? And we saw a good example of a good one this morning as we look at hymns throughout the week. I'll try to highlight that for you. Okay? So in our congregational worship, if it's going to be response to God because of truth about Him, then truth about Him, His character and His works, needs to be complete. It should magnify God's attributes of greatness and His attributes of goodness. Now, in theology class, you get into that. What are His attributes of greatness? What are His attributes of goodness? What are His attributes of transcendence? What are His attributes of immanence? Some churches will tend toward just emphasizing the attributes of the greatness of God. You know, I would argue that the Catholics, Anglicans, even Lutherans to some respect, do well in emphasizing the attributes of God's transcendence. I mean, He is this otherly God. But they fail in accurately focusing on His attributes of immanence. He is with us. We have access to Him through Jesus Christ. Some churches emphasize heavily God's attributes of immanence, His attributes of goodness. He is a personal God. He is kind. He is good. He is loving. To the neglect of His attributes of greatness. So if we are going to properly respond to God and to truth about Him, it has to be complete. We have to emphasize both. Now, in one service or another, there might be more of an emphasis on one or another. In one given hymn or another, there might be more of a focus on one or another. But all in all, our worship needs to be the worship of God as He is. And He is a great God, and He is a good God. He is a transcendent God, and He is an immanent God. So we need to have both. And then furthermore, in this God orientation, expressing truth about God we're talking about, that's the main heading, the musical style should be worthy of the truth. The musical style should be worthy of the truth. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about this tomorrow, but in general, I want to just hit it here. Since it is truth about God that is being expressed in congregational worship, we must be very careful how the music portrays Him. We do not want to portray God as romantic, as trivial, as sentimentalistic. And yet, I think much of what passes for congregational worship music today does portray those things. Now, tomorrow we're going to talk about how it does and how we can distinguish it and that sort of thing. But just I want to start talking about it just from a philosophical perspective at this point. Okay? So, that's expressing truth about God. Now let's talk about directed toward God. Our worship is supposed to be directed toward God. and this broad philosophical principle of God orientation in our worship. Our worship should be directed toward God. And we talked about this already a little bit. But the point I want to make here is that we need to diminish the focus on us and aim the focus toward God. Which I think is a lot of the problem with some of the church music that developed during the Middle Ages under the realm of the Roman Catholic Church. Or some of the, you know, you could walk into a Roman Catholic church today and some of the music that they do, the lyrics present heresy. Okay, so it's invalid. But the choir might sing something else. You might listen to the lyrics and the music and say, that honors God. Now, in this context, it doesn't. And by the way, if I were, for instance, to go to, you know, I've never had the opportunity or reason to do this, but say I went, you know, a relative of mine or a friend of mine were getting married in a Roman Catholic church, I would go. But even if they, like, say they sang a congregational hymn, say they sang Holy, 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 great hymn, right? And the Catholics do sing it. I wouldn't participate in that context, even though it's a good hymn. But I wouldn't participate. That's free. Anyway, what was I saying? Oh, yeah. Part of the problem of a lot of the high music that was developed during that time that is God glorifying, that is beautiful, but part of the reason I don't think it's necessarily appropriate for congregational worship is that because it is so virtuosic and so big and bombastic, it draws the attention to itself and not to God. So I'm not just talking here about bad styles of music that take our attention off God and take it to man. There could even be a good form of music that is so virtuosic that it draws our attention to the performer and not to God. If our worship is going to be biblical, it needs to be God-oriented, which means the focus needs to be on God. Okay? Let me see what I can skip since we're behind time here. Okay. What about our offerings to God? How can we I'm talking about our monetary giving, our giving of praise, our musical expressions in a worship service. How can those be rightly directed towards God? Well, one of the principles we saw yesterday in our scriptural data gathering is that God has always demanded a level of excellence and beauty. Remember in Malachi when God was condemning their worship, what did he say? He said, you know, you're doing the letter of the law, you're bringing me sacrifices, you're obeying what I've said, but you're bringing me the runt of the litter. He called them deceivers. Here you have a good, you know, offering sitting at home, and you're bringing me the leftovers. God demands excellence. He demands good and pure. Now, let us be very clear here. What we bring to the Lord does not earn us merit. It's not as if the better offering we bring, the better standing we have before God. Our merit is solely through the blood of Christ. But what we bring to the Lord in terms of its excellence or in terms of our best does express what we think about God. It does express whether or not we think he's worthy of our best, or whether something else is worthy of our best and he's only worthy of our second best. Now, I keep saying this. We'll get into this a little more tomorrow. But by excellent and best, I don't mean big and flashy and virtuosic. Okay? I just said, that's not good because it draws attention to itself. But I mean, in itself, it is of good quality, it is of high quality, whether it's, you know, what we give to the Lord of our money, what we give to the Lord of our time in a service in ministering, or whether we give to the Lord in our music. Okay? Yes, sir?
Like, how is it? I'm not trying to sound argumentative. I'm just curious. I mean, we know Jesus was a homeless common Jew, you know, and the Bible says that he had no majesty about him, and there was no beauty in his appearance that should attract us to him. So, I mean, God in the flesh came down and was a homeless man, you know. Mm-hmm. So how do you reconcile that? And, you know, concerning the sacrifices in Malachi, like, God clearly was attacking their heart, you know. They were not good sacrifices. They were bringing poor quality sacrifices because their heart was off.
Absolutely. Right.
You know.
Yeah, excellent. Good. It's an excellent point, which is why I just said, I'm not talking about something big and flashy and virtuosic. You know, some big, hey, look at this. I mean, this is the Pharisee and the publican in the temple. A person with nothing can give a widow's mite. But it was her best. You know what I mean? So it'll be different from person to person, from church to church, from culture to culture.
But doesn't that kind of violate the objective standards of beauty? I mean, because objective standards don't change. You know, like from person to person or culture to culture.
Yeah, there's a difference between, let me see how I can argue, and again, I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time right now because we will get into this tomorrow, I promise. Okay? There's a difference between beauty versus ugly. Ugly. And complexity versus simplicity. I totally had a problem with this. These are not equal. Something can be beautiful and complex, or beautiful and simple. Something can be ugly and complex, and ugly and simple. The standards by which we judge these things are the same, are objective. But I think what you're thinking of is in terms of something complex and big and grandiose, as opposed to something simple. I think a child can offer a simple song of praise to the Lord that is not complex in any way, shape, or form, but is beautiful. And a child can also offer something that's ugly. And so we're going to explore this at length tomorrow. But it's a good point. It's a good point that I'm not making. I'm not saying that we have to offer God something complex. In fact, the point I made a moment ago is that often that is not good. To offer God something complex often will draw attention to itself and not to the object. Okay? And this was Luther's point. Remember we talked about Luther? He wanted beauty and simplicity. That is, I think, the best for congregational worship. Objectively beautiful and simple. Okay? So we will get to that. Now, let's interact a little bit with those who say that it doesn't matter what we offer to God, that only the heart matters. For instance, Steve Miller is a defender of this kind of relativism, where, you know, it doesn't matter. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. There are no objective standards. It doesn't matter what we bring before God. What he would say is this. If you think it's acceptable, then it's acceptable. Okay, if you think this is good, then it's good. There are no objective standards by which to measure what is acceptable or unacceptable for offering to God. The problem with that is it denies human depravity in determining what is acceptable. You understand what I mean? If I am the ultimate judge, I am denying that my judgment may be marred by sin. I need another standard outside of myself. So the principle is, we need another standard. We can't just trust ourselves. Okay? And here's just to wet your whistle. Does the Bible say we need to offer beauty? Does the Bible portray beauty as something objective. Well, listen to this. 1 Chronicles 16:29. Ascribe to the Lord the glory due his name. Bring an offering and come before him. Worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness. Well, now you're going to say, well, what does that mean? How do we know? Tomorrow, okay? But the point is, it's there, and we need to wrestle with it. What does he mean? Let's see, skip over that. Psalm 29:2, same thing. Ascribe to the Lord, glory to his name. Worship the Lord in the splendor of holiness. Psalm 44:11, and the king will desire your beauty. Psalm 52, out of Zion, the perfection of beauty, God shines forth. Okay, so there are evidently objective standards of beauty, and that's what we're going to wrestle with tomorrow. Okay? And like I just said, Martin Luther is the perfect example of this, like we looked at the beginning. He said, there are objective standards of beauty, and high art exhibits them well, but it's not accessible for people. Folk music is also beautiful, and it's accessible. So let's combine them to form what we're going to use in our church music. Okay? Now, with all of this focus on the fact that congregation will center on God, I do not want to imply that the worshiper will receive no benefit himself. There will be horizontal benefits. So our basic principle has got to be God-orientated. About God and to God. About God and to God. About God and to God. So does this mean there's no horizontal? Does this mean that there's no benefits for the worshiper? No, there are. Sometimes people will insist that we should not only be concerned with the vertical, we need to be concerned with the horizontal. My argument is that when you correctly focus on the vertical, the horizontal happens. If you focus on man primarily, I am arguing, man's needs are not met. But when you focus on God and his truth, when you elevate him, then there are horizontal benefits. Perfect example of this is in 1 Corinthians 14:5. Paul's talking about believers worshiping God acceptably, correctly, and when that happens, visiting unbelievers will witness the power of God and be converted. So the question is, when an unbeliever comes to the worship service, what does he see? Does he see a lot of people who are interested in each other? That's good. But he can get that at a social club. He can get that at the local YMCA. He can get that at a 12-step help group. People are concerned about each other. What he needs to see is people in a community worshiping something greater than themselves, which is what leads to their concern for one another. And in a worship service, that's what they see. 1 Corinthians 14:15. Unbeliever comes, sees people worshiping God, and falls down and says, God is here. People are converted by seeing believers worship their God. Okay, so in all this talk about God orientation, realize there are horizontal benefits to this. And we're going to talk more about this when we talk about the principle of our congregational worship service being congregational in nature. Okay, so summary points on this philosophical point. Some conclusions. Number one, the church has many functions, many purposes, such as fellowship, evangelism, discipleship, and worship. It is important that all of these things take place. Fellowship, discipleship, evangelism, worship. These are all goals of the church. But often, worship takes a back seat to these other things. Or if a church says what they are doing is worship, it's often more of these horizontal activities rather than the vertical. It is important that churches set aside specific times for congregational worship and that these times be God-oriented, about God and to God. Okay? So first of all, congregational worship must be God-oriented. Second, congregational worship must be doctrine-oriented. If worship is response to truth, spirit and truth, then you've got to have the truth. You've got to have the doctrine. And yet there are those who will say, we need to have as little or as shallow or as light truth as possible in our worship services. You know, the deep stuff, the doctrines of Scripture is for something else. Maybe discipleship, maybe a theology class. Worship should just be shallow and light and fluffy so that we can just enjoy our time. Okay, you'll hear that. For instance, John Frame, remember I told you about him? He's the one who redefined the regulative principle. In his book, Contemporary Worship Music, which he redefines the regulative principle, he says this about Charles Wesley's hymn, Arise, My Soul, Arise. Do you know that hymn? Arise, my soul, arise, sing off thy guilty fears. Great hymn with a lot of really significant doctrine. He says this, although it is a good teaching hymn, it is not easily remembered. I have sung it 100 times or so, and I still have to open the hymnal to get the words right. Okay, that might be true. And so then he goes on to say, really, you know, it's a good teaching hymn, but it's not really good for congregational worship because it's too thick, too deep. We need something shallow. Maybe repeat the same thing over and over and over again. That's better. Okay, so that's the tension. That's the debate. And obviously then that would filter over in more than just the music. The preaching needs to be light and shallow and fluffy. Nothing in the service should be deep or doctrinal, these people would say. He said this, he's arguing for what he calls contemporary worship music. So he would say CCM is the broad category, but not all of it is used in worship. So he's talking about contemporary worship music. So he calls it CWM. A good CWM song in the same doctrinal area as Arise, My Soul, Arise, lost my place, would focus on one of the 15 points. So he says there's 15 doctrinal points in that hymn. That's way too many. A good song would focus on one of those points, surround it with hallelujahs, show how that point should matter to the singer, set it to a memorable tune, and give people some time to meditate on the wonder of that biblical teaching. Now, there's a truth in what he is saying here. But the problem with it is that without a proper understanding of God as expressed with the doctrines of the Bible, we're not really responding to God. Now, can somebody in the early stages of his Christian life, you know, he doesn't know much yet, he learns one truth about God and respond in worship? Absolutely. But that should grow. Our understanding about God and the Bible and the Scriptures and doctrine should grow. And as it does, as we understand deeper truths and more truth about God, then our responses deepen and grow and increase. And our life changes, that response of action. And our love for God increases. Remember, that's Ephesians chapter 3 from Monday. As we grow in our love and our knowledge of Christ's love for us, our love for Him deepens. And this is the problem I have with what John Frame is saying. He is advocating in our worship, it all just needs to be surface and light and simple and repetitive, and never get deep, never get anything serious. But that leaves the response at only one level and never progresses into a deeper response. Never grow, and there's no growth. Defenders of this will again, all of these things, they go back to the Psalms. Okay, they will appeal to the Psalms, and they will say that the Psalms resemble modern praise courses. Have you heard that argument? It's common. What's the problem with that? This little book I told you about yesterday by Peter Masters, the pastor of Spurgeon's old church, he deals with this argument quite extensively. And he demonstrates, he shows, that all of the Psalms, except for five of them, all of the Psalms contain sufficient matter to be converted into paraphrases or hymns of at least 5 hymn stanzas in short or common meter. And most hymns are longer than that. So he kind of just blows that argument out of the water. You know, it's kind of an argument, well, the Psalms, they look like praise choruses. And he says, well, let's look at them. No, they don't. There is deep content in these things that could be easily converted into a 5-stanza hymn. The other thing, just as a side note, you know, these people were saying, boy, this is what we should be using, these simple things. And yet, what did people use for hundreds of years? I mean, for hundreds of years, they didn't have these simple praise choruses. What did they do? For hundreds of years, they sang deep, weighty, doctrinal hymns. How did they make it? Maybe it's a change in us, and not in a change of what we need for worship. That's the problem. We talked a moment ago about the Great Awakening. Jonathan Edwards and George Whitefield. People were converted. There was a revival in the land. You know what hymns they promoted during those meetings? The hymns of Isaac Watts. You know, you think, well, all right, for certain settings we should sing doctrinal hymns, but if we're, you know, people are going to be saved, we need to sing light, fluffy things. Well, if you look at history, men like George Whitefield, Jonathan Edwards, Charles Wesley saw many people converted using deep doctrinal hymns. Why? Because I would argue the same thing I argued a moment ago. It is only when people really understand who God is that they are converted and that they worship. And we're not presenting a full picture of who God is with just one layer of shallowness. Now, some people will say, you know, music, shallow preaching is defended by saying that, well, new Christians can't handle deep truth. Okay? John Frame argues this. He says, CWM, contemporary worship music, praise choruses basically, is Christian music that is immediately accessible to the young as well as the old, to the immature as well as the mature. What's the problem with that? Think about the epistles. Do the epistles contain quite a bit of deep doctrinal truth? Well, yeah. To whom were they written? New churches, new converts. A lot of time the pastors of these churches had only been saved for a short period of time. This was right at the beginning of the church. And yet Paul, you know, we get this idea that, okay, you know, we need only so much truth to get saved, which is true. You know, we need to understand the gospel. We don't need to understand everything about Christianity in order to be converted. And that's all we really need to go after we're saved. You know, if maybe later on you can learn about these other truths. They're for the scholars, for the learned people. But that's not how the New Testament is presented. The New Testament is presented as, this is truth we all should know. It's hard, some of it. It's deep, some of it. But let's wrestle through it. Another point here is that there are several passages of Scripture in the New Testament that are written in poetic form that were likely the hymns of the early church. So here we've got early church plants, new believers, new converts. And these are the kinds of things that they sung. For instance, Philippians 2, 6 through 11 is written in a poetic form that was likely a hymn. You know this passage, who being in the form of God, thought it not robbery to be equal with God, made himself of no reputation, took upon himself the form of the servant, made in the likeness of man. Being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself, became obedient to the death, even death of the cross, wherefore God has highly exalted him. You know that passage? That was likely an early hymn. That was no praise chorus. That was no shallow expression of doctrine. That's deep doctrine. 1 Timothy 3:16. Without controversy, great is the mystery of godliness. God was manifest in the flesh, justified by the Spirit, seen of angels, preached unto the Gentiles, believed on in the world, received up into glory. It's written in a poetic form that was likely an early New Testament church, a New Testament hymn. 2 Timothy 2:11 through 13 is also likely a hymn. Other passages, John 1:1 through 18, Ephesians 1:1 through 11 is most certainly a hymn. chapter 2, verse 14 through 16, Colossians 1, 15 through 20, Hebrews 1, 3. All of these are deep doctrinal hymns sung by new Christians in the first century church. Okay? So when we're talking about being doctrine-oriented, we need to present God for who He is as He is expressed in His Word. Now again, and we'll explore this, it's we're not talking about complexity versus simplicity necessarily. But the mark of a good hymn is that you can keep coming back to it and keep seeing more. It's like a deep well that you can keep coming drinking out of. That is why praise choruses never last for any length of time, because after a while you've done it already. Let's go on to the next one. We always have to find something new, something more exciting. It's the nature of pop music. All right, let's see here. We are pressed for time. Let's move to the next one. And we'll be almost on track. All right, because we need to spend a lot of time here. So, congregational worship must be God-oriented, must be doctrine-oriented, by the very nature of what it means to worship. If worship is a spiritual response to truth about God, then there's got to be truth about God. Okay? Number three, congregational worship must be affection-oriented. Affection-oriented. Congregational worship is the spiritual, inward response to God resulting from an understanding of biblical truth about God, expressed publicly in a congregational setting, etc. So we're talking now about the spiritual response element. And here is another area where our impreciseness with terminology has caused a lot of confusion. Okay, so we are saying affection-oriented. I did not use the word emotion on purpose for a number of reasons, one of which being this. Today in our discussions of emotion, we normally see emotion as just one thing. And it's kind of neutral. It's how I feel. And the only way that I can judge it is by the object, what I express that emotion to. That kind of thinking about emotion was never thought that way until the Enlightenment, which we talked about a while ago, when we had to scientifically explain man. So man now is chemicals and sinews and physical, and he is emotion that was part of man that science, that rationalism came up with. Prior to the Enlightenment, there was no such thing as emotion. It just wasn't talked about. So let's explore about how this was discussed prior to the Enlightenment. First, how the Greeks described it, because this is important, because the New Testament writers use this same language when they talk about it in the New Testament. Okay? The Greeks viewed man as having four parts. The mind, okay, the seat of the intellect. Okay, we still think in that way. Then they spoke in terms of the upper chest, which they called the stathos. They used medical terminology or physical terminology to describe parts of man. We get our word stethoscope from this Greek word, the upper chest. Okay? This was the seat of the noble affections. Things like courage and love, the noble affections. Then he had the lower chest, which they called the splanchna, which is basically like the organs of the lower chest. that's a technical, physical term for those things. So they're using a meta, they're using metaphors, just like we say, "I love you with all my heart." Well, do we mean boom, 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 right? We're using a medical terminology to talk about the seat of our emotions. Well, that's similar to what they did. This was the seat of the tender affections. Things like mercy and kindness, those sorts of things. Okay? Then they talked about the gut, the koilia. And this was the seat of the base passions. Things like appetite, you know, things that everybody has and just kind of is part of us as humans, or even really animals have these things. Appetite, sexual drive would be included here. Those sorts of things, base passions. Okay. The reason I'm doing this is because the New Testament employs this language, because they were in this culture, they were accustomed to this language, they were Greeks, Greek speaking. Actually, by the time of the New Testament, these two had combined in language, and they used the term splankna to talk about the affections in general. Okay, now, what the Greeks taught and the New Testament authors confirmed. And the Greeks, you know, were not believers, but they had this right, evidently, because the New Testament authors, which I'll show you in a moment, confirm this, is that we need to be driven by our mind. Right? Isn't that what the New Testament teaches? You know, not to be driven by our emotions. You get this preached to you. Don't be driven by our emotions. Be driven by what you know. Our mind should affect our will. We need to do what we believe. Okay, the mind, the reason, is more stable. It should control us. So in terms of New Testament Christianity, what we believe about God, what we believe about Jesus Christ, needs to affect our lives. So it needs to control us. We should never, ever, ever live by the gut. Never, ever should we be controlled by our appetites. Never ever should we be controlled by sexual drive. Now, are those things wrong in and of themselves? No. We need appetite. We eat. Okay? But we can never let them control us, because they will always lead us into self-indulgence. But what the Greeks taught is that when the mind is pitted against the koilia, the gut, the koilia always will win. I talked about this a little bit on Monday. You can believe something, but if it's pitted against your gut, your base passions, just believing it is not enough. And we've all experienced this. You know you shouldn't do that, but you do it anyway. Why? I mean, do Christians fall into immorality? Why? Because they are letting their base passion of sexual drive, which in and of itself is good in the context of marriage, they're letting it control them. They're letting it drive them. Obesity. Do we need to eat? Is appetite good? Yeah. Do we know, hey, we really shouldn't eat that much? Yeah? So why do people get obese? Because they're letting their koilia drive them. So how do we, you know, so how do we get our mind back in control? The only way for our mind to defeat our koilia is if it is supported by the splankna. Don't you love that word? I love you with all my splankna. Try that one next time. That's what the Greeks would have said. And this is exactly what we saw in Ephesians chapter 3 on Monday. You only will do what you love. Intellectual assent alone is not enough. It has to be supported by love for those beliefs, and it is only then when they will affect your life. That's what the Greeks meant, and that's what the New Testament talks about. Your mind will only be able to have victory over your gut, over your base passions, if you have affection for the things that you believe. If your mind is supported by your affection, you will defeat the passions. Or you will control the passions. Because the passions are not bad in and of themselves. But they need to always be kept under control. So in the New Testament, for instance, when Paul says their God is their belly, he's using the word koilia. And obviously a negative sense. He's talking about, you know, reprobates. People who don't love God. People who don't obey God. Their God is their appetites. Their God is their passions. Their God is their base gut instincts. Those just control them. Okay? But on the other hand, he talks very positively about the splankna. And somewhere in my notes, we're going to go through these passages. I'm surprised. Oh, here they are. Here we go. I was looking for them. I couldn't find them. Romans 16:18. For they are such, for they that are such serve not our Lord Jesus Christ, but their own belly, their own koilia. Philippians 3:18. For many walk, of whom I have told you often, and now tell you even weeping, that they are enemies of the cross of Christ. He uses the word koilia to describe such people. On the other hand, Philippians 1:8, for God is my record, how greatly I long after you all in the bowels of Jesus Christ. You ever wonder what that means? The bowels is the word splankna, the intestines. It's love, it's affection. Some translations translate it not bowels of Jesus Christ, but affection of Jesus Christ. So the translators were translating it very literally. That's the literal rendering of splankna, not the metaphorical rendering. Philippians 2:1. For if there be any consolation in Christ, if any comfort of love, if any fellowship of the Spirit, if any bowels and mercy. See, the King James translates that word very literally. Bowels. Well, it was a metaphor. It was a metaphor for the affections. Colossians 3:12. Put on, therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, bowels of mercy. You ever wonder what in the world is they talking about bowels? It's exactly this. It's the word splankna. Okay, so the Greeks talked about it. The New Testament confirms it. You never live by the gut. You never live by the belly. See, so in our day and age, this whole category is all just called emotion. And so what has that done to us? Certain Christians, charismatics and others, say we need to have more emotion in worship. Okay? But what do they mean by it? And because that has happened, we fundamental Baptists, we're afraid of emotion. Well, yeah. But that's because we don't have in our language a way to distinguish this from this. We should be afraid of this. And this is what we are afraid of when we say we're afraid of emotion. Okay? It is an unhelpful term simply to talk about emotion. We need other categories. Well, so how did Christian people for hundreds and thousands of years talk about this before the Enlightenment came around and just lumped this all into one thing? You know, why did they do it? Because, you know, sometimes these are called the animal passions. I don't really like that word, but what they mean is, you know, even the animals have this. This is just part of our physical makeup. Animals have appetite. Animals have sexual drive. So do we, okay? Well, the Enlightenment wanted to link it because they wanted to say, well, we're just like the animals in all of this. And that's why they did it. Because we're no different than Henry VIII or whatever. Okay, so we need new categories, new terms, and they're not new terms. How do Christians talk about this forever? Well, they use these exact words. It's unhelpful to talk about just emotion. Instead, let's talk about the affections and the passions. So anytime you hear someone talking about emotion and worship, you need to ask, what do they mean? If any of you come up to me and say, should we have emotion and worship? I'm going to say, what do you mean? Because the word emotion is not a helpful term. And let me give you an example, all right? Well, I'll get to that. Okay, so the one who articulated best the difference, and with this we'll take a break, the one who articulated best the difference between the affections and the passions was Jonathan Edwards. He wrote a lengthy treatise called The Religious Affections, which is what my website is named after. Okay, here's what he said. The affections and passions are frequently spoken of as the same, and yet there is in some respect a difference. So even at his time, people were starting to talk about them the same way. But he said there's a difference. Affection is a word that seems to be more something more extensive than passion, being used for all the vigorous, lively actings of the will or inclination. Okay, so what he was saying is, affection is the inclination of the will. In other words, Monday's message, Ephesians chapter 3, affection is the link between the head and the hands. Affection is the link between intellect and will. Affection is the thing that tells your will this is what you should do based on what you believe. But passions are those that are more sudden and whose effect on the animal spirits, just meaning the physical body, are more violent and the mind more overpowered and less in its own command. Okay, so he is expressing what we just said. The passions are those things that are sudden, they're more violent upon us, and they overpower our mind, if not kept under check. Okay? You can never have too much of the affections. And we're going to explore what those are more. But you have to always keep the passions under check. Yes?
So the girl says that she's really emotional. Does that mean she's poila?
Probably. No. And it's not necessarily bad as long as it's kept under check. But you all know if you let your emotions get ahead of you, get in control of you, you've got a problem, right? It's the koilia. You know, something like, for instance, fear. And this is where we gotta distinguish, and we'll take a break. I said that already once, right? Fear could be either, because there is something as a healthy fear, based on reason, helping us to connect what we believe with how we should act. But if something happens and you're so overwhelmed by fear that it overpowers your reason, that's a problem. So you got to keep that under check. So when a girl says, "Oh, I'm emotional," and lets it control her and it gets out of whack, that's a problem. And girls are not the only ones who are like that. Guys, admit it. In your soccer games, when there's a foul you don't think was there and your temper starts to flare. Koilia. Right? And you act out of your mind. You hear that term. You're out of your mind with rage. Right? We use this language. It's exactly what we're talking about here. You are out of your mind with rage. That's wrong. Right? You should never be out of your mind. So in order to prevent that, you've got to have the noble affections for God and for truth and for what you should be doing, supporting your mind so that you never are out of your mind with rage.